by the National Science Foundation around the topic of interdisciplinary research. And in this four-part sort of mini-series, I guess, each speaker has brought a little different perspective on what interdisciplinarity does or means to the field of language documentation. Today we have Jeff Good from University of Buffalo, right? Okay. Anyway, who's been working in Cameroon in Africa. And Jeff just explained to me that it's not so much the project itself started out as an interdisciplinary project, but rather they're making use of a lot of interdisciplinary data. So as I said, each talk puts a little different spin on how you might integrate language documentation with other disciplines or think about it. And that's all I'll say, because I'm cutting into this time.
Thank you. Okay, the handout's going around, but you don't need the handout for the talk to start. And I don't need a microphone, do I? Okay, good. All right, so before I get to main part of the talk, I just want to put an acknowledgement slide up here. Lots of funders have helped out with this work over the years, lots of collaborators. I want to single out now NSF, because they've been the primary funder of a lot of the specific work I'm talking about here today, the Documenting Endangered Languages program. And of my collaborators, I want to really emphasize the contributions of Pier Paolo De Carlo, because if it weren't for him, there wouldn't be nearly as much kind of interdisciplinary data going on in this talk as well, and you'll hear reference to him later on in the talk, too. So as you heard, my sort of spin on this interdisciplinary theme has to do with using lots of different data sources to answer a kind of big question. And before I get to that question, I want to say a little bit about my field site, because you kind of need to understand it to know where the question comes from. So if you look on your handout map, you'll get the context. I'm doing documentation now of a number of languages in the lower Fungom region of northwest Cameroon. This is a hilly area in the Cameroonian grass fields. This is not actually all lower Fungom. Lower Fungom is smaller than this. Roughly, you draw sort of an oval around the colored village markers, you'll get lower Fungom. So it kind of crosses through that region. It's lower in elevation, which is why it's called that. And one of the things, it's not a large area. So it's about, you know, here's your 10-kilometer mark, but you get about seven languages packed into it. And to some extent, even if I use that seven language figure, it underestimates the diversity, because even where I use the same color village markers, like these five villages of the Mumbam cluster, there's lots of dialect diversity there, significant. So if you go from Aba to Misong, we're hearing a lot about Misong, you will find significant dialect differences in 5 minutes, if that, of elicitation. I mean, these are really significant dialect divergences. So even when you see the same marker, you're seeing a lot of diversity even more packed in there. Now, all of the languages are Bantoid. That makes them kind of cousins to the narrow Bantu family, but they're not necessarily closely related to each other within that context. And all the colored ones in Lower Fungom are actually in a referential classification, so I have that table on your handout, called Yemne Kimbi, and we use that classification to mean those five languages in Lower Fungom that we haven't connected closely to any other language anywhere else. So there's still a lot of diversity packed into this space. Now, that's the kind of big question that drives the research, in a sense. What is the sort of special magic of this area that allows it to be so diverse, right? Especially in this era of massive endangerment. But I find it, just to put it in some local context, I find it helpful to try to sort of give you an idea of how many languages are in such a small space. So let me superimpose it on a common geographical marker. So here we have sort of southeastern Oahu. So this is just a small part of Oahu. So Honolulu's down here, the airport's here. You're not even at that other, I don't know what they call that side of the coast, but you're not even there, you've driven through the whole region, right? So if you had a nice road within like 15 minutes, you can sort of pass through this whole seven language region, right? Now, when I first started doing research in this area, I figured I would do what we all sort of expect to do. You go and you pick a language and you write a grammar, you do your dictionary and all that sort of stuff. But no one else was interested in this region, so I thought I should do some survey work just to get a better sense for what diversity was out there. And then especially as I started looking at the significant dialect divergences, right? All these different sort of dialects you see in Mumbam, I started to ask myself, well, what's going on here? What is it about this region that is permitting all of this hyper-diversity? Now, if you look at the larger grass fields region of Cameroon, where this is embedded, that region itself is very diverse linguistically as well. But this is the real extreme point of this sort of region of hyperdiversity. And in the back of my mind was a kind of general question that's been floating around typology in recent years, as looking at typology, not simply a question of what are possible grammatical structures, but to consider this issue of sort of what's where, why, and really kind of bring this question of not simply asking the what of grammar, but trying to understand how the patterns are in each part of the world. So I'm following Bickel here. He's kind of looking at it a little more at a worldwide scale, but of course there's no reason why we couldn't look at it at a micro scale as well. when you ask a question like that, well, we're linguists, so the what is going to be a question mostly about grammatical patterns, right? That's kind of what we primarily care about. Obviously, we have some other interests too, but that's obviously the sort of bread and butter of the discipline. But once you start asking that where, well, in the Lower Fungum context, the where question is why is this region so diverse, right, compared to the rest of the world, right? What allows it to be so diverse? And again, in this era of large-scale endangerment, this is not a completely academic question, because if we can understand why all these small languages and dialects are sort of doing well, and if you look on your table, you'll see the populations are all quite small, but they're still pretty vital. There's no problems with, you know, children learning them as long as they're raised in the villages. What is allowing this region to sort of go against the worldwide trend, right? But then as soon as you get to the kind of interesting question, the why question, right, what's going on and why is it different, then suddenly you're going to have to leave linguistics to a large extent, because that's where this interdisciplinary data comes in. Because linguistics can tell you how it's different, but it's not going to give you the full picture of why it's different. So you're going to have to bring in data from other domains. And so what I want to do in this next part of the talk is go through some of the different kinds of interdisciplinary data that we're trying to use to get to this why question. And I'm going to focus on one of the villages in particular, because it's the easy one to do in a sort of short talk, right? Mm. So the sources of information that we're going for here then are different ones. So obviously we're looking at comparative linguistic data. This is really of sort of two kinds, general comparative linguistic data, but we come at this from a sort of Bantuist Niger-Congo comparative perspective. So some of the data is targeted for what you need for languages in this part of the world, right, in a way that family expertise lets you sort of go after certain kinds of changes. Also looking at ethnographic investigation with a real focus on essentially language ideologies, language and identity issues. We want to understand how these villages understand their relationship to their languages, because obviously that must be some role in this diversity. Doing a lot, as much as we can, with geographic coordinates and sort of topography, so you'll see a little bit of that. The region, as you can kind of see from the background, is quite hilly. A lot of the villages are clustered on hilltops for defensive purposes. There's sort of a larger picture going on there. And to some extent, this is, I should almost put it in scare quotes, shallow archaeological exploration. We're not really digging, but trying to look at sort of older habitation sites to sort of reconstruct settlement patterns. What I won't talk about today, because it's not as relevant to the one case study I'm doing, is looking at archival records too, as a probe into actual history. I find sometimes that linguists either want to rely on oral history, or they assume that wherever the speakers are when the linguist first bumped into them is where they've always been. But even in Cameroon, like, the colonial records from the early 20th century already are telling you that things were not, I mean, even in 1900 they were different from 1950. And especially in that, you know, this was first a German area, but then under British control, and you can go to various archives and actually not guess in some cases, but I won't go into that as much detail here today. Okay, so what's where, why? If I want to talk about the whole region of lower Fungum, I obviously can't do that in a short talk. So I'm going to focus on the one village where the picture seems clearest, where the data is sort of pointing in a nice direction in a useful way as this exemplary case. So it'll be this village here, this one Mumbam-speaking village of Misong, the most divergent in various ways. Here's the chief of Misong as well. So that's why he's pictured there. As we'll see, he's one of the only things that actually unifies the village, which is somewhat interesting in its own right. This is a case for this slide where you might want to turn to section the sort of grammatical data on Misong divergence on your handout if you have that. So
are there any extra copies of the handout?
Yeah, they around? And you can follow me more or less without it, but now you can at least look at the data. So the first thing you know, if you were just doing linguistics, you immediately discover Misong is different. Okay, so linguistically it is different, it is divergent in all sorts of ways. If you look in your lexico-statistical chart in sort of bullet one of the handout, you'll see there's no question Misong is Mumbam. It's part of this language or dialect cluster. That's not at stake. If I were to do the same lexico-statistical similarities with any of the other languages of Lower Fungum, it would be much lower. There's no question. But still, Misong against the other four Mumbam villages has a markedly lower lexico-statistical similarity, so it's different lexically. Not on your handout, I don't give you data for vowel length, but vowel length has a very minimal contrastive role in the other four villages, but in Misong it has a much higher functional load. It has a different pronoun, which is somewhat striking, so it has a pronoun, a form B for the second person singular, where the other languages all show something with a W, right? Some variation because they're dialects, but this B is clearly a distinctive sort of etymon there. And then if we look more morphologically at patterns of verbal stem alternation, all of the Mumbam languages have a perfective-imperfective verb stem alternation reminiscent of, say, Germanic strong verbs. So certain class of high-frequency verbs have irregular alternations. Munken, I give you Munken data in three, that's the normal pattern where some verbs do nothing, and verbs that do something seem to alternate with a more front vowel in the perfective against a back vowel in the imperfective. Whereas misong uniquely has some cases of back vowel alternating with front vowel, and also some cases of verbs that add a velar nasal at the end as well. So we're even seeing differences there in this pretty irregular part of the grammar. These are areas, these are places you don't expect to see significant borrowing, etc. And so we have this problem, right? So linguistics says, why misong, why is it different? But we're going to need to look at other data to try to answer that particular question. And one thing I want to add here, and I can't make this whole case, you know, in the 20 minutes today, is as far as we can tell, misong, to the extent that it's a distinctive dialect, is only maybe 200 years maximum, maybe 150, 200 years. The differences you're seeing cannot plausibly result from natural language diversification, right? This is not, I mean, you'd have to go through the whole picture, but this is not a case of this was the first dialect to split off. There's clearly other things going on, right? Something is causing it to change quickly, especially if you look at some of these strong verb alternations. I don't think that's going to happen in 150 odd years, given otherwise stability of these systems in the other dialects, right? What's nice is, as you start bringing in different kinds of data, a consistent picture emerges, and they all sort of converge on the same thing, which misong is a relatively new variety, formed as a certain kind of language mixing, probably, of other languages coming in, and there was pressure for it to become distinctive in the last couple centuries or so. So ethnographically, the first thing you notice is that misong is sort of the least cohesive of the villages in the whole region. So one way you see this, all the villages of the area divide into quarters. Quarters are typically exogamous. They're kind of like, they're conceptualized as kin groups, so you don't marry within them. Only in misong are quarters not exogamous. They divide two ways into two moieties, and you can marry across them. In that sense, the quarters look a little bit more like independent villages in terms of marriage relations. There are ritual sites that proliferate across the quarters. More typical is maybe the chief's quarter has the dominant set of ritual sites that are sort of signifying this is the central place of the village. Misong, again, the quarters look more independent. Not many strong village-wide institutions. Secret societies are the especially important village-wide institution in this part of the world. You don't really see them as strongly in misong compared to the other villages, except for the chief. And one other thing that I don't list here, the other thing is the language. The dialect variety is the other village-wide institution. Because as it turns out, as we'll see, you can't be an independent village without an independent language in local terms in this part of the world. So there's this pressure to differentiate yourself. And I'll also sort of give you an example of an oral history, because the oral histories are completely consistent with this ethnographic picture. So here's a quotation from, he doesn't live in Misong now, he lives to the north, but Makwa Guo Amos, about his sort of family's story and how they came to Misong. As he says, and this is not, I mean, probably some of this is practically living memory. We're not digging too far into the past. As my father told me, we were from Fong side. You'll see Fong on your map as well. It's sort of in the lower corner of the region. He doesn't mean they're from the village of Fong, but just from that direction. When you people are cooperating, you speak one language. If you speak one language, you cooperate. As a group of relatives moves, the brothers may decide to split, each choosing a different place to stay. This is what happened to us. Each family attached itself to a village and therefore had to speak the general language used there. For example, we Bamyan attached ourselves to Bikwam, these are quarter names, and hence had to adopt their language. Bikwam people are attached to Bajumbi and Bianzam to form the village of Misong, and they had to speak Misong. No, there's no ethnic identity here, there's no ancient identity, there's nothing that says, oh, we Misong have been speaking Misong forever, this is the language of our ancestors. You don't really find that, especially in Misong, but you don't really find that mostly around that area. Except maybe a chief will say that, but the chief has a stake in claiming sometimes, but even then it's not quite the case. So that same picture, their oral histories are completely consistent with this idea that they're a recent formation of families coming together, right? So we'll just want to sort of elaborate that story. But before I do that, I want to bring in two other kinds of data. First, our use of GIS technology to plot different kinds of aspects of the region geographically onto a particular space. So this is work cited here, DiCarlo and Pizziola. They were looking at what they're calling kind of memory places, among other things. And when you collect oral histories or different stories from the villages, and you try your best to link places that people in the village talk about as part of their history to time depths. So if we go back, some villages seem to remember places going back to the 18th century. The box there is Misong, nothing there. Misong don't remember anything. They don't talk about anything that far back, right? Maybe they were there, but they don't talk about it if they were there. They don't think of themselves that way. But if we get to, say, the village Abba, clearly sort of says we've been here a while. Ngum, which is probably one of the oldest inhabited sites, seems to think they've been there a while, right? As we go to the 19th century, Misong starts appearing into the record, but not as extensively as the other places. Now, it's not just Misong that comes in. You'll see suddenly the Fong remember lots of things. They're almost certainly recent immigrants. And then the caution up here, if you look at your handout map. So this is, there's good evidence to say that a lot of these groups are recent immigrants, although the Misong is the most difficult case because they speak this Mumbam language as opposed to a one village language like the Fong. The Fong almost certainly moved in. The Misong is a more complex case because they're speaking a dialect so closely related to the other groups. But the village seems young, if not the language in the region. And then we go to the 20th century and there's still more of a proliferation, but as you can kind of see, now every village remembers something, as you'd expect by the 20th century. But again, we have this idea that there's something kind of new, quote unquote, to Misong going on there. The next picture and the final bit of interdisciplinary data that I'll talk about today, not counting the archival data that we're also using, that's sort of data from history, has to do with doing kind of archaeological layering. Now, this is not hard archaeology. You don't have to necessarily be an expert to do this. All of these triangles are different archaeological sites. Pier Paolo De Carlo is the one who surveyed them. I haven't seen most of them. But the issue is basically looking for cases where, for instance, you see house foundations. These are not hard things to see, right? The people move around a lot. In a lot of cases, they moved up to hilltop villages in the last 150-odd years because of a period of political instability. And you can go and you can see, oh, look, there are houses there. So this is not particularly difficult. With a good GPS device, it's not hard to map them. The circles represent places that are inhabited today, right? So in some cases, like Aba here is associated with a small outpost of small Aba. So there are some extra settlement sites. And the triangles are archaeological sites. If we highlight Misong here again, and then we get rid of the settlement patterns, there it is again. We don't see any old archaeological site associated with Misong and some of the other groups as well. If you look up here, the village of Wunfu, you can kind of see up here, that one pretty clearly, they had a more dispersed settlement pattern, lower, not as high on the hill, and then they had to sort of come together and build a wall for defensive purposes. So you can really see that very closely for that village. Misong is not one of those villages, right? It looks to be, again, a more recent formation. So that takes us to this question then, so what's going on? All the data seems to converge, and there's a more detailed picture to paint, but I'll paint it in broad strokes here. That Misong is not what sort of Woodbury refers to a kind of ancestral code, right? So if you were just naive, you would go to this area and say, oh, Misong must be the ancient indigenous dialect, it must be the first to split off from the rest of Mumbam and all that sort of stuff. And therefore we should document it and maintain it. But in the reality it seems to be something very different, what I'm just informally calling here an expedient code. In this part of the world, if you want to create a new political entity like a village, you need a new language. Well, what probably happened, we think, is that as this period of political instability was happening, various families had to come back to form a new village, presumably the chief's village. The head kin group was a Mumbam-speaking group, so that basically became the core language that they built on. But they also needed a distinctive identity, and new families speaking other languages that we can't yet identify came in, and some of the elements of their languages became mixed in with Misong, both to reflect this kind of hybrid identity, but also as a tool to make Misong more distinctive quickly, because they were going to need ways to sound different fast in order to be independent from Mumkan, Aba, and all the other villages that otherwise linguists see as speaking Mumbam, right? So this variety exists as the expression of this kind of ephemeral political configuration, and we can tell different stories or similar or different ones for each village, right, as we sort of put together this data. So I think what we can see is by combining data from these different disciplines, we can get this clearer picture of what's where, why, right? We can say Misong is there because it's a recent formation. They seem to mix in other languages to express because of the nature of local language ideologies, right? And that starts to give us a picture for why this whole region is as diverse as it is. All right. So now I want to go back. That's the case study of what we're doing and how we're trying to piece it together. We can do it for other villages as well, not always with the same success. And I want to see if we can draw some general conclusions, right? Maybe for those of you who are kind of intrigued by this approach, maybe you want to try this yourselves. I think we've been relatively successful for approaches that use some of these interdisciplinary data. In just a few years, we've been able to sort of get a pretty view of what's going on faster than I had anticipated. And I think often when I hear about interdisciplinarity, I've heard, and not to parody too much, but I know I've heard things like this. Linguists say, well, the music is really interesting where I am, so why don't I get an ethnomusicologist? Or the culture is really interesting, so I need an anthropologist. And they sort of start with these vague ideas of, wouldn't it be great if we all cooperated? But they forget, of course, that disciplines exist, and we're not very good at cooperating, or there wouldn't be disciplines, right? So, I mean, that's just sort of how it is, right? They all exist in their world, and you can't just expect it to happen naturally. What I think happened in our case is we actually started with a research question. Why is the region so diverse? And that focused us. So even when we were working, when Pier Paolo was working with a geographer, or I'm working with him, he's more of an anthropologist, well, we all have our different things we're interested in that the others don't care about. That's fine, right? I mean, that's okay. But as long as we're all interested in this question, then we find that commonality. And so our collaboration centers around answering a question that we all find intriguing. It doesn't center around this kind of vague notion of wouldn't it be nice if we all got along, right? So we knew that when we needed ethnographic data, we weren't getting just anything. We wanted to get things that had insight to language ideologies. That was interesting to the anthropologist, but it's interesting to me, for instance, right? Same with some of the geographic data. We focus on those things that are particularly common. In that sense, those intellectual commonalities helped us get past the sort of inherent interdisciplinary differences. Now, I thought I'd give a brief biographical note about how I started going across this. Again, if other people are kind of interested in being able to deal with these kinds of issues like that. The way I had to start doing this was to read everything on the region, which is something that I think most documentary linguists don't do enough. I wish I had done it even before I went to the field site. Ethnographies, anything on archaeology, anything I could find on the region, because I needed to have a sense for how the other disciplines were approaching this part of the world. I needed to get a sense for what questions animated them, even if I didn't care about them. I just needed to kind of get a sense of where they're coming from. And it's easy reading, too. It's easier than reading a grammar. You know, like, an ethnography is actually quite enjoyable if it's good. And then I had to accept that, of course, the disciplines are disciplines. I had to accept them for what they are, and then, you know, try to focus on what they could, you know, how we could help each other, rather than worrying about the fact that, yeah, occasionally you read cultural anthropology, and they say things that sound a little odd to a linguist, but I put that aside and focused on what made sense, right? A final thing, when looking at collaborators, though, I wasn't necessarily looking only for specialists, the people who are supposed to be best, but intellectual personality mattered, because ultimately each person has to meet the other halfway. And not everybody, sometimes the most brilliant people in their disciplines have no interest in meeting you halfway, which is why they're brilliant in their disciplines, right? So you have to find people who are really open to that sort of interchange, and that you're going to waste a lot of time at first, have a lot of failure in a sense, as it were. But I want to take a step back and just conclude, and I'll sort of finish up here about talking about the first step that I had to make, I think, that sort of opened this up, which is that documentary linguistics, as you know, Woodberry describes, is really focused on this idea of preserving the nostalgic ancestral code. And we really focus on documenting languages. But the first step to this for me was actually not seeing my primary job as to write a grammar or just to sort of document a lexicogrammatical code, but to decide, well, there's something else interesting going on here, the way these languages are packed into this space. So I had to actually step beyond my own disciplinary confines. Even if I had no idea how to deal with it, I had to decide that I wanted to ask a question that was not the standard kind of question, which I think is where a lot of these collaborations end up beginning. So I'll leave off there. I'm a little over time anyway, so thank you.
So thanks, Jeff. Any questions?
Yeah. I'm really curious about how these opposing ecological pressures happen, because there's this huge ecological pressure in this language to speak like other people because it's your village, because you guys are all bound by a village. But you did say that there's huge, that's the only thing that binds them besides the chief.
In this particular, other villages, and you know, in the whole Grassfields area, this is the extreme fragmentation. In the center of it, you get larger kingdoms where there's sort of larger language areas, still with dialect differences.
But what I'm thinking is that there should be a huge amount of variation, because as people perform their various identities and don't agree with each other on anything else except for, so I'm just wondering how that works.
The core unit is the kin group, and so everyone is going to be under a big man, and whether it's a real kin group or partly constructed, everything is built on the model of, even the village in a sense is understood as an extended kin group. So at a minimum, you will follow whoever the sort of big man, if I can use that term, is in your unit. So that's that core cohesion. In the ideal world, we know that never patterns out ideally. When he decides we're going to another village, then everybody is supposed to kind of shift. But they don't forget the other one. Languages here are these sort of tools to access these different political powers or access different powers. So almost everyone is multilingual. And so they have that other language at their disposal. If they don't like the one village, they can go back and kind of reactivate that other allegiance. So there's sort of, I think, you know, we see this a lot even in our own, you know, like what in, say, like the U.S., culture, you know, where people have dialects or registers. It's kind of like that, except that instead of just having a register difference, you sort of link it to the whole level of a completely different code, right? So you're sort of linking it to these different levels. So, but there are other means of cohesion. So in a more cohesive village, you have secret societies where different men from each quarter have to participate, and women. So the women and the men together are using that as a means to sort of enforce certain kinds of commonality. So there are other mechanisms. Misong just happens not to have them because of its
So it's, is it the king who makes the language changes then?
We don't know. That's
come
an
on.
Interesting question. Now, no, we don't know. We would love. I think that the villages are fall apart enough that I think my hope is we can keep this up. If we were to able to be there for 20 or 30 years, we'd probably be able to watch something like this happen more directly. I don't know if we'll see a village form. Settlement is a little more rigid, I mean, with the modern state. But some of the villages are close to dissolving, so we would love to be able to maybe track some of these families and sort of see what happens as they move. Is it the chief specifically? No, it shouldn't be, in the sense that there's this. The chief is the thing for fusion, but there's also this tendency towards fission, and they're going to have to compromise. I mean, you got to imagine the head of a different kindred is probably going to have some say, if not the total one. So, but no, we don't know. We'd have to wait to capture it.
Do you think it's conscious?
I think that it is more conscious than we probably want to give credit for. I mean, so how conscious is it? I don't know, but I'm sure some of it is somewhat conscious. And I would love to know, because then we open up this issue of, you know, Sally Thomas has written about this in recent years, of deliberate language change, which is this completely unexplored area. And I'm really interested in that, because ultimately I come to this area because I'm interested in comparative Bantu. And if this social dynamic characterizes the whole region and there's more deliberate language change, we don't know how deliberate language change as a typology is distinctive from natural, if there's such a thing as language change. So mm-hmm. I think there's some, I usually say semi or quasi conscious, because I can't imagine that there's not some consciousness, you know.
I really appreciate you bringing in the issue of ideologies that speakers have towards their languages, and I just wanted to note that that's also a useful lens in looking at the different disciplines that you're bringing together. I mean, you've discussed what you call the naive perspective on privileging the older static code over a newer fluid code, but it's also an ideology that the discipline of linguistics has.
Yeah, and it's one that fits really well with certain parts of the world, and it's really, but I mean, at least the Cameroonians I work with, they're so not like that you can't, you just end up divesting yourself of it, because they don't have those notions of purity. I mean, Sub-Saharan Africa is usually described as sort of syncretic. It's just a place where purity is just not a very active notion in those societies. They'll just sort of grab, they like to do that, and so as soon as you get in, the language is no different from clothing patterns or food patterns or other cultural patterns, right? So it's just something, this is a part of the world where that ideology is put into focus is not fitting, the sort of ethnic, national ideology that, you know, we inherit from Germany, 19th century Germany and France and all of those places. I think you're definitely right.
If I can just add in, though, there is some interesting work on language repertoires and registers in youth language, which I think would go along with this idea of deliberate change.
Yeah. And certainly, to the extent that you can see it in Africa, it's been best studied in urban environments, the creation of youth vernaculars. Because it's easier to see it there, although probably similar. The youth are probably just sort of recapitulating a pattern that was already existing in the rural context in a new urban way, but we haven't been able to observe it as closely in these more rural environments. Yeah.
I was curious, at what stage did you begin the collaboration? So had you already done a lot of field work there?
I had two trips. I focused actually on a language that's kind of marginal to Lower Fungo, Naki, which is just outside inside. The second trip, I started doing the survey of the rest of the region, and don't I'm not as rugged as I look. I was staying in town and bringing people to me because I only had a few weeks to do the survey. So I'll be full disclosure there. It was after I came back and said, what's going on? Then I was able to sort of piece together a larger project. And then the real collaboration started after NSF kindly gave me some money to hire Pierpaolo DiCarlo, and then we could really push forward. One of the issues with this is you're probably not, you know, you're going to have to do some pilot work before you're able to, you know, put together a project like this. If you're doing these kind of sociolinguistic issues, you're going to have to be on the ground quite a bit before you even know how to structure the problem. As opposed to the more traditional project where it's easy to say, no one's ever looked at this language, there's 200 speakers, it's endangered, give me money and I'll document the code. That's something you could do without necessarily having that same lead time.
And did he have experience in the region?
He did not. So that's what I said, intellectual. He had experience doing what I thought was very relevant work in Pakistan.
Okay.
But of the people who worked in Africa, none of them had that. So he was really interested in what he called loci of cultural reproduction, which linguists don't think about much. But what are the aspects of culture that are the really central ones to keeping the culture going? And he was interested in how language, which verbal art, which kinds of language are the most important language for transmitting language ideologies. Mm-hmm. right? And that was the skill set that, so in that sense, I didn't look to Africa, I looked to someone with that, that skill set in examining ideologies, which is what I mean by if you just are vaguely like, I want to be interdisciplinary, you would get someone who seems to match, but they may not match because you actually need someone who was a slightly different expertise.
Yeah, a lot of times it's difficult to find somebody who's working in the same region
yeah.
you're working.
And that's another, obviously, a related issue.
Time for one more quick question.
Well, I think I saw you.
Is that me?
Yeah, you
okay.
can start, please.
actually, this is really interesting, so I'd like to talk to you more because I work in a very similar seeming region in farther west in Africa.
Okay, where?
Benin and Togo.
Oh, okay, sure. I should say, whenever I present it, like, people say, oh yeah, my region's like that. It just hasn't become visible enough. But yeah, so it's a
question. So my question that came out, and actually hopefully it will be quick. Is there a, like for just for that specific village, is there sort of a knowledge of sort of different parts coming from different places? Do they know where they came from?
Well, you saw that to some extent. So you saw that, it depends which quarter. So one thing that I didn't know until later, this is why you need to keep going back and really be in the field, is that if you ask for an oral history, the first one you usually get is the oral history of the chief. The official oral history matches the chief's oral history. It's not like the other ones are secret, but they don't. That's not the one you'll ever get first, so you have to ask for it. So you saw that one, I gave you that one oral history quote from, so yeah, you can get other stories like that. In fact, even some villages like Munken, which we think has been around for a while, also Munbam up here, they claim to come from somewhere else, and so you have to decide what to do with that. This oral history data has to be worked with carefully. So with Munken, we think, well, maybe a prominent family came from outside, as if the story of Norman French, as if the British were now French because the story of England became the story of the French conquerors. So working with the oral history is something that you have to, you know, so it's another, I don't know if you call that, if that's more of a kind of an anthropological issue, but there is a literature on how to take oral history facts and align them with truth as we understand it in our academic context.
Thanks, Jeff. Thank you, everybody.